On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Hockenberry, and this is On Point. The rise of Iran, the oil-exporting Shiite Islamic nation, has skillfully emerged as a regional power broker since the U.S. invasion of Iraq, with new influence from Afghanistan to Lebanon. Now it is signaling that it is willing to flex its muscle to the world community by acquiring a nuclear capability. Can Iran be stopped? Should it be? Is there a way to coexist with a nuclear Iran, to contain an Iranian superpower? Can the global community deal with a leader who openly threatens Israel and has denied the Holocaust? Is it imperative to open a dialogue with the world's newest emerging military power, regardless of the rhetoric? This hour on Point: Rogues, Realists, and the Iranian Bomb. Joining me now from Washington is Michael Hirsch, senior editor at Newsweek magazine. Michael, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here, John.
Where do you think we stand at this point? It certainly appears as though Iran has something of an upper hand here, and Washington's influence is at best unknown at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the bottom line, based on this most recent exchange, the Iranian response to the Western proposal and the U.S. Response to that, which was rather fuzzy compared to the rhetoric we've seen in recent months, I would say that the traditional diplomacy, the diplomatic approach by which the European three, Germany, France, and Britain, have led these talks with the U.S. backing, I think that's pretty much over now. I think even though we're going to go through the motions of another Security Council resolution that's scheduled for August 31st, the Iranians, are basically on their way to mastering the nuclear fuel cycle. They've had technical problems, but I think what you need now is a new deal of the diplomatic deck, so to speak.
Do you think that the European three and the United States can change the rules of engagement here in diplomacy, or, merely give the Iranians another chance to grandstand and to state that they're making progress and moving forward? That certainly seems like what the last Security Council resolution amounted to.
Look, the unfortunate thing here is that Iran is in a very strong position right now anyway. The perception is that its proxy, Hezbollah in Lebanon, was not taken out by the Israelis. It's got a lot of prestige. It's got a fanatic, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, as its president. And it has basically maintained its position of not suspending its uranium enrichment program, which was the red line last spring for the United States and the Europeans. And in fact, the U.S. and the Europeans appear to be the ones who are softening their response. Iranian message yesterday was, we'll talk, but we're not going to suspend, basically. And you saw how soft the response was from the U.S. The Western European countries didn't really say anything at all. So I think that, we just have to have a reckoning with the idea that some new kind of diplomacy, which I believe needs, involves U.S. leadership, the U.S. getting directly involved in a way it hasn't before, needs to be pursued, or alternatively, I think you're looking at military action.
Well, what's curious to me, and maybe I'm wrong here, is that the U.S. appears in this whole diplomatic thing to be a bit in the group photo rather than taking a leadership role. And I can't really tell if the U.S. is merely responding defensively to Iran, or perhaps more alarmingly, merely responding defensively to China and and Russia, which have declared they don't support sanctions under basically any circumstance. Which is it?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. The U.S. approach to Iran, and for that matter, North Korea, has been much more reactive than proactive. Clearly, if you want to step back and look at the overall picture, we've seen a shift from what many people thought of as a very stark unilateralism vis-a-vis Iraq in the first term of Bush to what might even be viewed as an excess of multilateralism, where the U.S. is not taking the lead, the U.S. is not assuming its role as the global leader, and is allowing the Europeans, in the case of Iran, and China, in the case of Korea, to take the lead. And you have to question whether that's been effective. Clearly, the diplomacy is going really nowhere on any of these fronts. I think it's really unrealistic in the extreme to think that a sanctions regime, a mild one, most probably, adopted in the next several months by the West toward Iran is going to prevent the Iranians from mastering the nuclear fuel cycle, which they could do as soon as the first quarter or so of 2007.
Or barring that, push oil prices to $100 a barrel. Michael Hirsch, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Hirsch is a senior editor at Newsweek magazine. He spoke with us from Washington. Joining me now in the studio is Jim Walsh. He's a research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. Last month, he testified before the U.S. Senate on Iran and the nuclear issue, negotiated settlement or escalation. He was in Iran last February and will be traveling to Iran again in the fall. His forthcoming book is about U.S.-Iranian relations. Mr. Walsh, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, John.
You know, it appears as though Michael Hirsch is saying that, you know, there's a multilateral mush at work in U.S. policy. But looking at it from the Iranian side, I mean, it makes sense that they would emerge here as a regional power given the debacle in Iraq. Is the nuclear threat serious in a strategic sense or purely a nationalist sense inside Iran?
Well, I think the bomb I won't call it a bomb program. I'll call it a nuclear program. That's an important distinction. In Iran is driven primarily by national pride and internal politics, less by security threats. The only real security threat to the existence of Iran that leaders in Tehran face is an attack by the United States. Short of that, there's no country in the region that's going to wipe them out unless they were to attack Israel, and Israel responded with a nuclear weapon.
But plenty of countries that want to contain them, the
absolutely.
Saudis being a Sunni nation,
yes.
And certainly the Israelis.
But a nuclear weapon doesn't really help you if your opponent has a containment strategy. So I think it's really less driven by security. In fact, you could argue that the surprise here is, you know, this program's been going on for 20-something years. You might argue that the surprise is they haven't done more in the nuclear arena, especially having had Saddam as an enemy over these past 20 years. I think it's really much more an issue of national pride, more like the French program or India's program than a program like China or North Korea's, which is driven by interests and driven by a sense of being threatened. And when I say pride, this is what I mean. The Iranians look around the world and they say, we're a great civilization. We're a leading power in the region, and yet no one takes us seriously. We don't get any respect. We're not in the world stage. We are here. We're important. Pay attention to us. And they also have some views sort of that are hangovers from the 1970s that somehow nuclear energy is a cutting-edge technology that's going to bring them into the 21st century. And you combine those two things, a sort of lack of sophistication about nuclear politics or nuclear technology, and a deep sense of victimization and a strong sense of nationalism, and the result is a pro-bomb or not pro-bomb, a pro-nuclear attitude.
So the development of nuclear power and possibly nuclear weapons is a replacement for the maybe tired old confront the great Satan, jingoism in Iran that was so effective for domestic politics for the last 20 years.
Absolutely. I mean, for a lot of countries, and Iran is not alone in this. As I said, it's not only Iran and India and France, but you can think back to Argentina and Brazil's programs. Nuclear energy is symbolic. It means technical autonomy. You can produce your own energy. It's high-tech energy. It's seen as clean. It's seen as being independent of the rest of the world because you can produce your own energy without depending on the supply of others. And it's a sense that you're part of a club that's one of technical achievement. So all those things, the prestige of it all, is very attractive to some leaders.
Of course, you could say exactly the same thing in the high-tech context about solar energy, but unless there's no solar bomb, so I suspect it doesn't have the domestic power the other argument. Well, then let's turn it to the other side. Is there anything to fear from Iran getting a nuclear reprocessing or enrichment capability strategically in the region or outside?
Well, obviously, if you can enrich or reprocess, that does put you in the ballpark where if you want to later on, you can build a nuclear weapon. Now, that's one of the problems with the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty is that customarily, countries have been allowed to have enrichment and reprocessing as long as it was for civilian purposes. The problem is once you have it, you're one hairline away from being able to jump over and get a bomb. But traditionally, we've allowed countries to have that. I think that's probably a mistake. But is Iran a threat? I think there are two extreme views here. One view is that this is a crisis, and Iran's going to get the bomb tomorrow. And the moment they get the bomb, they're going to use it. They're going to give it to terrorists, or they're going to bomb Israel. I think that's there's no evidence for that whatsoever. But there's another view that says,
well, was there evidence that the U.S. was going to nuke Japan before it happened in August of
1945? No, but that's the only case. The only case of an offensive use of nuclear weapons is 50 years ago, over 50 years ago in World War II. Since then, we've had seven or eight additional countries get nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons have not been used. They've never been used offensively since World War II. And it's hard to use them for blackmail purposes. And no country has ever given a terrorist a nuclear weapon or another weapon of mass destruction.
So in your view, potentially, this is more an opportunity for engagement with Iran than it is an opportunity to call them a rogue state, to reemphasize the axis of evil rhetoric?
Well, I don't want to see, just to finish out, the one extreme is to say it's a crisis and the world's going to end, and the other extreme is to say, hey, it's okay if they get a bomb. I don't think that's good either. More nuclear weapon states increases the chance that those weapons will be used at some point in the future, and there are all sorts of other problems. It hurts the nonproliferation regime. But I think that rather than treating it as a crisis and therefore being pushed to extreme action where we feel like we have to threaten them, we have to politically escalate or even consider military action, I think those remedies are the very thing that will guarantee that Iran becomes a nuclear weapon state in the future. The more you threaten them, the more you isolate them, the stronger the pro-bomb constituency in Iran grows. So this is an opportunity to for Iran and the U.S. to talk about the whole list of issues, differences, and areas of mutual interest.
Joining me now from Washington is Robert Litvak, Director of International Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Center. He was Director for Nonproliferation at the National Security Council in the first Clinton administration. He is the author of Rogue States and the U.S. Foreign Policy, Containment After the Cold War. His forthcoming book is Regime Change, U.S. Strategy Through the Prism of 9/11. And also with us from Washington is David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power. Power. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thank you, John.
I'd like to begin by talking about, you know, we've just seen this crisis in Lebanon emerge and perhaps pause here for a moment, and who knows what the trend lines are there. But certainly it has illustrated a relationship between Iran and Hezbollah. In the nuclear context, as we attempt to confront Iran in the United Nations and within U.S. foreign policy, what can you say, and I'll begin with you, Robert Litvak, about the potential for Iran as a nuclear power having influence on Hezbollah or developing a Hezbollah nuclear capability?
I don't see that as an imminent threat. States have been extremely circumspect with respect to how they've handled nuclear weapons. I think there are two routes by which a non-state actor could attain a nuclear weapon. One would be a handoff, and the other would be some type of leakage from inadequately secured materials. I think the latter route by which a non-state actor could attain such a capability is much more likely than the direct handoff. I think Iran, even in its relationship with Hezbollah, has been circumspect in terms of not transferring certain types of capabilities, such as chemical weapons, to them. So the notion that Iran would attain a nuclear weapon, achieve a nuclear capacity, and then hand off the crown jewel of its arsenal to a non-state actor over which it does not exert direct control, I think, is unlikely. But just one final point on Hezbollah. The relationship between the Tehran regime and Hezbollah, it is strategic. That is, the activities of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon are viewed as an extension of the Iranian revolution. So I see this, the linkage more in that respect. That is, the Tehran regime views Hezbollah's activities as a source of its external activities legitimize the regime at home. And I think that type of subtle and complex linkage between domestic and foreign is really where I would put greater emphasis than the specter of a handoff of a nuclear weapon from Iran to Hezbollah.
All right. David Rothkopf at the Carnegie Endowment, do you agree? And what sort of tactical value would a nuclear weapon have to Hezbollah, given that it's in such close proximity to Israel?
Well, let me cast the issue slightly differently. My concern with Iran and Hezbollah has two components. I think it's right to think that it's less likely that Iran is going to hand off a bomb to Hezbollah, although I have to say betting on the rationality of the regime in Tehran is not something that I'm particularly comfortable doing. The other possibility and consequence of nuclear Iran is that it then is able to operate under a kind of a nuclear umbrella, as Hezbollah is its actor elsewhere in the region, and it might feel freer to unleash Hezbollah in different ways. It might feel more immune to certain kinds of attack if it has a nuclear deterrence, and thus you're empowering the oldest, best-funded, deadliest terrorist operation that exists in the Middle East at a time when it's absolutely clear to us that they are an arm of Iran strategically.
So short of delivering a weapon, a stronger nuclear Iran would have benefits strategically for Hezbollah in its region in southern Lebanon.
Absolutely, and I think that there's another dimension to this entire thing, which is, yes, no other nation has used nuclear weapons offensively since the United States, and yes, we've been pretty lucky that far, but, you know, you only have to be wrong once. And as the number of nations that have nuclear capability grows, the risk grows. And Iran poses a special risk because it's an extremist regime that is a known state sponsor of terror, that has stated a desire to destroy another nation in the region, a nation that could fairly quickly be destroyed by nuclear weapons, and could use the nuclear leverage in a whole variety of other ways, including potential destabilization of the world's access to its oil supplies. And thus, you know, it really gets us to the question, okay, well, diplomacy doesn't seem to be working. NPT is dead, and effectively it is. And so at what point do you actually take action? Do you wait? Do you hope that things are going to be fine with Iran and only plan to take action later? Or do you take action beforehand because you think the risk is too high?
Well, let's step back for a moment. I mean, certainly the administration's rhetoric on this subject and a lot of the analyst talk on this subject describes the risks of nuclear proliferation in Iran. And some of the things that David Rothkopf was saying there a moment ago certainly sound familiar. And then there's also the issue of rogue states and axis of evil that are the defining terms of the Bush administration about Iran and places like North Korea. Does this policy of declaring states to be rogues and of declaring non-state entities to be terrorist organizations not worthy of diplomatic dialogue, is this getting a little tired at this point? I mean, there certainly don't seem to be a lot of pragmatic results from the policy as it is right now, Robert Litwack.
Well, my take on the issue is that this type of rigid categorization and lumping states under a rubric, you know, has tended to straitjacket U.S. foreign policy and frustrate our ability to pursue targeted, discrete policies and strategies towards each of these very different actors. I think that the big change from after 9/11, as we come up on the fifth anniversary of it, was a change in thinking, as the Bush administration has put it, that the threat derives from the very character of our adversaries in this new era, rogue states and terrorist groups. And that has recast the debate over the last several years. One saw it in Iraq, and one sees it now with Iran, North Korea, other cases. Whether the U.S. objective should be to change the regime or to change the regime's behavior, there's been this fundamental unresolved tension in U.S. policy, and one sees it very clearly playing out and sort of muddling our approach in dealing with Iran. And my view is that we don't know if Iran has made an irreversible decision to acquire nuclear weapons. Its actions belie statements that it's not pursuing a nuclear weapons program, but we can observe that this is not a crash program. They're not trying to get a nuclear weapon at breakneck speed. They've not dropped out of the NPT. This contrasts with other countries which feel that they face existential threats and need a nuclear weapon immediately, a country like Pakistan or Israel. So I think that we need to test the proposition. And part of the testing of the proposition is clarity on this fundamental issue of what our objective is, that the United States needs to offer a credible assurance of regime security, that that the United States will not attack the regime if it were to comply with the non-proliferation norms. This was the crux of the deal with Libya in December 2003. My position is that we need to test, frame the test for the Iranians in a way such that if Iran says no, it allows for us to we would be in a stronger position in terms of getting multilateral support for sanctions or tougher measures.
Gotcha. So rogue state.
The United States has to be willing to take yes for an answer.
Right. Well, rogue state or not, using the Libya model, engagement appears to offer more options than non-engagement and pure rhetoric. David Rothkopf, do you have a response?
Well, first of all, in characterizing the situation in Iran as somewhat greater threat than I felt that it had been characterized perhaps by others, I was not recommending for a moment that we follow the Bush path or suggesting that engagement was not an option. I think engagement has to be an option. I think effective multilateral diplomacy is crucial. I think finding a way to particularly establish a way to work on this with the Chinese, who have a much greater incentive to make this work than, say, for instance, the Russians, who actually benefit from instability in the Middle East due to rising oil prices, is really important for the United States in this. But there is no way that we are going to have an effective negotiating posture if it is also, or be able to accept yes as an answer, unless it's absolutely clear that we will not accept no as an answer. And we cannot let the experience in Iraq, which has been a disaster from the get-go and clearly based on erroneous intelligence, remove or put us at a remove from the reality that the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction to potentially bad actors is the biggest national security threat we face, and that there are certain circumstances in which the United States has to be ready to take military action.
What is the action, and what is the sort of end game, particularly if the answer continues to be no? That's the crucial question for David Rothkopf, visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thank you.
And also Robert Litvak, Director of International Security Studies at the Woodrow Wilson Centers. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
With me in the studio is Jim Walsh, Research Associate at MIT's Security Studies Program and an expert on Iran. You know, very interesting stuff and a complicated situation, but I'm reminded of the history of our relationship with China. Before Nixon went to China, China was the scariest place on earth. I mean, we didn't call it China. It was Red China. And then all of a sudden, boom. What's the transition here?
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, John. I know I agree with David that, and I've devoted most of my professional life to this issue, that nonproliferation is very important, that a nuclear weapon being used is the worst thing we can imagine. But we also have to make wise choices, and part of making wise choices is understanding the history. China, by far, was the most roguish of roguish states we have ever encountered. It said that it was going to give nuclear weapons to other countries. It was not in the UN. It was not in the NPT. It said it would fight a nuclear war and win, that weapons were a paper tiger. But it became a nuclear weapon state. The U.S. thought about attacking it, actually. Talked to the Soviets about preempting, as we did in Iraq. The Soviets said, no, thank you, and that was a wise choice because we didn't end up doing that. China got the bomb. I wish they didn't have it, but they turned out to be much more responsible than their rhetoric or their regime type would have suggested. In fact, what happens, for good or for ill, is that when states cross the nuclear threshold, often they become more sober. They are less likely to get involved in crises because they don't want it to escalate to a nuclear exchange. Now,
and engaged in international cooperation. I mean, whatever you want to say about China, they've been influential in a positive way on a whole variety of issues since becoming a part of the, you know, world community.
Absolutely. And that trend line has been in one direction. They have been slow, but they've become over time more engaged and more committed to nonproliferation. Again, that's not an argument for Iran to get a bomb. I don't want them to get a bomb, but we shouldn't go off the edge here and forget the history that's gone before.
All right, we're going to take a call here. Masood is calling from Fairfax, Virginia. Masood, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Thank you very much. I just want to make two quick points, please. First of all, Iran is like nothing else that's happened in the past. It's going to be something new. Iran is wallpapered with the evidence of what it's promising to do with the bomb. And its tactical alliance with China, especially with Russia, is to get us out of the region. And they believe that that will create a domino effect that will free them from us as well. Thirdly, Iran has a three-layered nuclear program. The outer layer is designed to be bombed and make Iranian government 1,000 times more powerful. An inner layer is far faster, and it will succeed. And then there is the secret inner layer with the Revolutionary Guards taking control of it. And when Iran becomes a nuclear power, which it's going to become, it's going to be a mortal enemy of Israel, and it's a regime that keeps the pot boiling by saying death to America, death to America. They're telling us they're going to kill us and they're going to have the bomb, and they're like nothing else in the past.
All right, Masoud, thank you. Jim Walsh?
Well, you know, I can understand why people say that. Certainly, Ahmadinejad, the president, has made statements that send chills down the spines of Americans, Israelis, and others, and there's a lot of rhetoric going on there. Of course, I think it's important to keep in mind that Ahmadinejad is not the head of Iran. The supreme leader is the head of Iran, and he's been that way. He's been in charge of Iran for over a decade. And during this decade, we have not seen an adventuresome Iran that has attacked other countries or transferred chemical weapons to Hezbollah or the other sorts of things that would be behavioral markers of a country that was going to run amok.
Indeed, but Iraq started the Iran-Iraq War.
Precisely.
In the 1980s.
And Iraq was the one that used the chem weapons, used mm-hmm. them against Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. Those are behavioral markers that tell you we got a problem person here. We have not seen that in Iran.
Let's take another call.
Sure.
George is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. George, you're on the air.
Hello. I've had a hard time listening here. There's somebody else on the line, but I hate to sound like an old fuddy-duddy. I spent 5 years in Iran, but long ago, in the 50s up to 60. The Iranians are not a warlike people as such, even though they fought valiantly against.
I'm not going to reveal my story.
No. And all of his talk on the administration just frightens me more and more.
All right, George, thanks for calling. You do have a cell phone problem there, but I think we get the point. And right. That is, you know,
well,
are the Iranians warlike, and is this the administration driving things?
Yeah. In international relations, you tend to make a distinction between status quo powers, powers who sort of like their borders, like where they're at, and want to increase their power regionally by influence, but don't look to change the borders, and non-status quo powers, like a Hitler in Germany that seek to invade other countries, or Saddam. For decades, Iran has been a status quo power. Yes, it wants to have more influence in the region. Yes, it wants to get recognized and wants to be a player, but it hasn't sought to change its borders by force.
Well, but what about the dynamic changes? I mean, Masoud alluded to this, and Michael alluded to this earlier. And that is, or David alluded to this earlier, and that is Russia really benefits with its oil wealth from instability in the region. They get direct cash when things stay this way. Is an alliance, implicit or otherwise, Iran-Russia, something that would really kick us over some threshold?
Well, let me be unkind to Russia in this regard. I think Russia's position in this is that of the opportunist willing to go to the highest bidder.
Jim, you know, when we talk about nuclear proliferation, we typically talk about proliferation of warheads or, barring that, proliferation of delivery systems, ballistic missiles, intercontinental missiles, that kind of thing. In the Iran case, we're really talking about the proliferation of a specific procedure for enriching uranium, the process of using gas centrifuges to separate fissionable U-235 out of uranium hexafluoride, if I'm not mistaken.
Well said, John.
And anyway, while that process is a significant industrial enterprise involving a lot of time and effort and care, the components for assembling a gas centrifuge are about as, you know, easy to get as wheat. it seems to me, thinking in terms of the gas centrifuge proliferation is a whole different way of looking at this. True?
Yes. I mean, it's important for listeners to keep in mind that the material for building a bomb does not exist in nature. You have to make it. You have to have one of two materials, either highly enriched uranium or plutonium. And the only way to get those is to acquire the technology to do it, one of the technologies you describe. The problem is the same technology that you use to produce fuel for nuclear power reactors, that is to say low-enriched uranium, is the very same technology that you can use to make highly enriched uranium, which could be used for a bomb. And traditionally, going back to the 1970s, when we thought nuclear power was going to produce energy too cheap to meter and everyone was going to have nuclear, we thought that the idea that there would be lots of countries with enrichment or reprocessing was a great idea. Well, you know, 35 years later, we figured out that that's not really a great idea.
But the consequence of that was that their whole manufacturing capability to make the tubes and the centrifuges and the monitoring equipment for these kinds of centrifuges, and AQ Khan in Pakistan, this was really his game. Selling the centrifuge stuff.
Absolutely. Now, having said that, you're absolutely right. And that's the most, if I was going to say that there was a single nonproliferation threat that that I would focus on, it's this idea that there would be sort of these private public networks of the model of AQ Khan that are out there working behind the scenes. The good news about AQ Khan is he was in business for 20 years and he offered a lot of this stuff around. And actually, there were fewer takers than you might guess. But yes, it's an issue. But again, let's not exaggerate it. Centrifuges are very delicate from an engineering standpoint, and they do require some specialized material, specialized steel. It's not going to be easy for Iran, especially when it's under U.N. sanction, if that happens, or under the watchful eye of the West, to quickly acquire all the parts it needs for a industrial-scale enrichment facility. As a little one right now, 164 centrifuges, you know, that's not going to really get you very far. You need the size
it's like
of a plant.
2 grams a month or something like that?
It's insignificant relative to what you would need to build a nuclear weapon. You really need thousands of centrifuges, and so they would have to engage in a lot more procurement than they are now. So it is a worry, and people like myself who spend our lives on nonproliferation issues are worried about centrifuges and this problem of enrichment. But it doesn't mean that Iran will have the bomb tomorrow. I can't emphasize that enough. This is serious business with serious consequences, but it's not a crisis that has to be solved today.
Avi from Bethesda, Maryland, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just want to make a couple of comments here. I think it's a very dangerous assumption to make that Iran will not use nuclear weapons if they develop them. And the problem is that really no one knows what is the timeline. You know, if you hear some reports coming from the intelligence community in Israel, they're talking about 1 to 2 years. If you listen to the American Congress, they're saying within 5 years. There's really no good solid intelligence telling us how, you know, what's the timeline. The other comment I want to make with when you compared Iran to China, I think there's a huge difference. Iran has aspirations to force their ideology on the region, and they made public.
And China didn't. China didn't have.
Ahmadinejad made public his plans to eliminate Israel, and I think this is dangerous. And I hope, I really hope that the UN will, for once. Make good on their resolutions.
Avi, what do you make of the fact that if Iran was to use a nuclear weapon of significant kilotonnage inside Israel, that one of the consequences would be to incinerate hundreds of thousands of Palestinian Arabs?
Well, I think this is a dangerous situation for the whole region. And I think that Palestinians, Israelis, everybody in the region need to be very afraid of what's going on in Iran. The fact is that they haven't opened their facilities to inspection, UN inspections in a long time. And I'm fearful of what's going to happen.
All right, Avi, thank you very much for calling. Richard on the line from Washington, D.C. Richard, you're on the air.
Thank you. I'm getting increasingly terrified of this, of the Bush administration moving towards Iran in the same way that they are moving towards Iraq. If you listen to what they're saying, they never refer to the government of Iran. They always refer to it as a regime. And I see this nuclear issue as sort of the, you know, WMD all over again. It's that, you know, it doesn't really matter. We don't care that a country has the bomb, that another country is getting it. It's who's getting it. And so the Bush administration, they're freaked out because it's this regime, and the whole point is removing the regime. That's the goal. The goal isn't having Iran as it is with the Ayatollah without nuclear weapons. The goal is having that Iranian government overthrown.
Mm-hmm. Well, Richard, thank you very much for calling. Jim, there's two different views but I would say the same degree of concern and worry about what the future bodes.
Absolutely. You know, and this is an important point. I think Avi is right to say there's no perfect intelligence about Iran. That was something that came out in a National Advisory Commission, a presidential commission a year ago, the Robb report. We don't know specifically. That means it could take Iran longer period of time, or it could take it shorter. Now, the Israelis have been predicting that Iran was just about to cross the point of no return, and they've done that three different times. So I don't think the Israeli intelligence claims have held up very well. Really, the group that knows the most is IAEA, and I think they're the one to keep your eye on. But to come back to the broader point, there's no free lunch here. You know, the advocates of military action say, well, we can't take the chance. This is something David was saying earlier. You know, if you're wrong once with nuclear weapons, you know, it's there's disaster. So we can't afford to take chances. And so the implication is, as with Avi's comments, we need to take military action. But military action could produce the very thing you're looking to avoid. It could guarantee that Iran becomes a nuclear power, because how are the Iranians going to respond? A nationalist country that feels like it's been victimized. If you attack them, that, I think, all but guarantees that a bomb will be built. And so no one wants a bomb. I don't want Iran to get a bomb. The question is, what's the smartest way to prevent that from happening? And I think Richard's right. I mean, it's deja vu all over again. Today, the newspaper is filled with reports that there are people in Congress criticizing the intelligence community for not coming out and saying that Iran is more dangerous than it is. This was what Cheney and Rumsfeld did in the run-up to the war in Iraq. A lot of the language is the same, and I too am troubled by it.
Chris from Boston, you're on the air. Go ahead, Chris.
Hi. I want to go just make a comment that's different than what everyone else is saying, is that I don't see how our safety and our economy or anything is served by being involved in the Middle East at all. This just seems like big government / empire to me. Like we're trying to micromanage the world.
Well, there is the little matter of oil, I would say, right?
Right. Well, our interests in the area are, from what I understand, are oil, which we get something like only 17% of our oil from the Middle East, and that stopping the spread of radical Islam. And it seems like we have better. It's better for us. We have more advantages in leaving the situation alone completely than being involved in it.
All right, Chris, thanks for calling.
Well, Chris has a good point, and it's part of a long tradition. I have colleagues at MIT and academia who have made a persuasive case that the U.S. would be safer if we just pulled back. Now, I'm not of that persuasion, but I agree that being engaged and being involved carries risks. If you do it poorly, then everyone gets mad at you. And, you know, Iraq is exemplar number one of that. If you're out there and show a leadership role but handle it poorly or have bad policies, then you bear costs and you carry risks. But on the other hand, if you do it right, you can make a meaningful contribution that really does improve your security and global security. Frankly, I think if the U.S. were to pull back, it's much more likely that countries would feel the need to fend for themselves, and that might mean more nuclear weapons, not fewer nuclear weapons in the future.
Well, we've certainly heard a plea throughout this hour, some from the callers and some from the other experts that we've talked to, including Michael Hirsch right at the top of the program, that, you know, there is a yearning or maybe a surprise that the U.S. is not more engaged, a yearning that it be more engaged, which implies that there's a consensus that there, in fact, exists a card that can be played here that absolutely prevents the development of an Iranian bomb. And I wonder if that's maybe the most questionable assumption of all. We don't have that card anymore for whatever reason.
Yeah, you know, but that's what public policy is about. You don't have many guarantees. And every option has risks and has potential costs. So you got to do the best. You got to make the best call you can on that day. And I think the best call is to use a card we haven't used, which is direct engagement with Iran. For over 27 years, we have refused to talk to Iran, like we refused to talk to North Korea for so long. Well, they are not recognized. We have no diplomatic relations. I think we've got these issues that divide us. The only way we're going to overcome the mistrust that we feel towards them and they feel towards us is if we sit down in the room and talk about our differences and our common interests, and that's what's missing right now.
Ed from Taunton, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Thanks. One of your guests mentioned before that it was, in fact, Iraq, that used the chemical weapons during the Iran-Iraq war, which points to, I guess, the question of not the country, but the leadership of a given regime or nation. being the problem. If we get to a point where Iran has nuclear weapons, who's to say that the supreme leader is no longer the leader of that country, and we now have a leader who has more questionable character?
So don't judge it by this government. Judge it by all the possible future governments. Ed, thanks for calling. Francis from Washington, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. It's interesting to see that all the permanent members of the Security Council all have nuclear weapons, and every other country might aspire for this. India wants it. And then also the two countries that have actually invaded other countries in the last 10 years have been what? The United States and Israel? Now, Iran has seen what happened to Iraq. What's to convince them that the United States wouldn't do that? And then also, how can you dictate to Iran when you haven't dictated to Israel? That being said, I believe by engaging Iran and talking to them and monitoring their nuclear power, we can constructively solve the problem, not by being bellicose and threatening sanctions and all the sorts and sundry.
Thank you very much. Jim, is the road to influence over Iran, does it pass through Tel Aviv and Jerusalem in terms of showing that we can have influence on restraining Israel in some way?
Well, I certainly think that it would be useful if all the members of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, including the United States, upheld their obligations, which means they're supposed to be – the nuclear weapon states are supposed to be reducing their nuclear arsenals. That's a legal international obligation. And it would help undercut the argument that the U.S. is nothing but double standards. We support Israel and its nuclear weapon. We build our own nuclear weapons. Then we go around hassling others. But that said, that's – the real issues driving this, I don't think, are the double standards as much as the internal issues between the U.S. and Iran. Israel is part of that. It's not the first issue. It's not the most important issue, even though it's often made that in political discussions. But it is part of it, and it's where it enters is what are security in the region? Is there some regional security arrangement in which all sides can feel safe and therefore not need to make resort to these sorts of weapons?
But say I'm an Iranian foreign minister, okay, and I'm sitting here with you and I say, you know, look, all the Security Council members, as the caller said, have nuclear weapons.
Yes.
And, you know, we want to be a member of the club. You know,
yeah.
You're buying our oil. You know, we're a big deal in the region.
Yeah.
You know, so why can't I have the bomb? I mean, what is your direct argument to Iran from their perspective that they're likely to listen to?
Yeah, well, the first argument I would say is it's against your self-interest. You are not going to be safer. This doesn't solve your security problems. And what's going to happen is you'll be less secure if you cross that nuclear threshold. You get a whole hornet's nest worth of problems that come with getting the bomb. Number two, you are a member of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, like the United States, like all but three countries in the world. And you have pledged yourself to not seek nuclear weapons. And you should abide by those promises and pledges that you made. Islam is one of the great traditions, religious traditions, and it talks about keeping your promises. If you are truly an Islamic state that follows the principles of the Quran, then you can't go around picking and choosing which commitments you're going to keep and you're going to break. You have an obligation to follow through.
All right, so I hop on a plane to Islamabad and talk to the Pakistanis and say, you know, Jim Walsh just told me that if I get the bomb, it's going to be a whole host of headaches and hornet's nests. What's it been for you? Is the Pakistani going to say, yeah, we wish we never did that?
Well, I think probably not, John. You're probably right to say. But then again, does Iran want to be Pakistan? Who wants to be Pakistan? Raise your hand. You know, I don't think you're going to get many takers for that.
Christine from North Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You're on the air.
Yes. I was interested in the suggestion that we should look back at some of the history of what's brought us to this point in time. And trying to put the other guy's point of view, judging from the interference of the West and in particular the U.S. In Iranian affairs for the last 60 years, would it not be possible for them to regard us as a rogue state?
Interesting question. Thank you, Christine.
Well, sure. Christine makes a fair point. You know, when I'm in Iran, when I talk to Iranians, they don't even have to go back as far as 1953 and the coup that the U.S. and the British engineered. That brought the Shah to power. They go just as recently as the Iran-Iraq War, when the U.S. and all of the West supported Saddam when he initiated that war. He started that war against Iran. The rest of the world backed Saddam. Saddam used chem weapons. The U.S. turned the other way and continued to support them. Iran went to the U.N. seeking you know, redress over the illegality of the war and the use of chemical weapons. They got nowhere. Hmm. So they have legitimate grievances, and frankly, we have legitimate grievances as well.
Prediction time, quickly.
Yes.
Do you think Iran will get the bomb? And secondly, do you think that this nuclear crisis, so to speak, will be an opportunity to end the deep freeze in diplomacy between the U.S. and Iran since the Iranian Revolution?
Second question first. I think it is an opportunity. I think, unfortunately, if the pass is any guide, we will miss this opportunity. We will not take full advantage of it, I'm sorry to say. And on the first, if we attack them, they will definitely get the bomb.
Otherwise, it's a strong
otherwise, it's
maybe.
An open question.
All right. Thank you very much, Jim Walsh. This is On Point. We've been talking with Jim Walsh, research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. His forthcoming book is about U.S.-Iranian relations. I'd like to thank all the callers, great callers. Thank you, Jim. I'm John Hockenberry, in for Tom Ashbrook, having a little trouble reading, but then I always have. This is On Point.